Now, when you look back over the history of close elections in Australia, and this looks like being one, the one coming, you don't need to look too hard. The most recent minority government was, of course, the Gillard government. PM Gillard relying on four crossbenchers to pass legislation. And despite expectations, that was not a bad time. They managed to pass some very significant law during that parliament, including setting up the NDIS. It was a carbon trading scheme, I seem to remember. Interestingly, the history of minority governments, well, they stretch back to our very first parliament elected on Federation in 1901. There have been many fragile parliaments since, some of which have worked, some of which have collapsed in a heap. To look back on this varied history and some of our closest election results, I'm pleased to welcome Campbell Rhodes to the program. Now, Campbell is the Copyright and Research Coordinator at the Museum of Australian Democracy, splendidly situated at the Old Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Sunday Extra, Campbell.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
1901. Let's start at the start, shall we? That first election, who was contesting that? Who were the parties at the time?
Well, that's an interesting question in itself, because the party structure at the time was a little bit looser than it is today. There was no unified Labor Party. It was individual state parties. You did have the protectionists, who were led by Edmund Barton, who was member at the time of the New South Wales Parliament. And you had the free traders, led by George Reid, who has also been a New South Wales parliamentarian and a former premier. And they had supporters in all of the other states, although the amount of party organisation was very different across the country. So a lot of candidates sort of stood as sort of independents or sort of adjacent to one of these two bigger parties. And once they had all been elected, they kind of coalesced.
I guess that focus on trade and how resonant that is with our contemporary moment. But the focus then, here we have a new Commonwealth, a freshly minted country trying to make a relationship with the world. It's obviously a thing which would occupy a lot of attention.
It was, and they called it the fiscal faith. So whether you believed in free trade or protectionism, so whether you believed in imposing tariffs or not. The strong tariff regime that they wanted to protect local industry was particularly popular in sort of rural areas of New South Wales and Victoria. The free traders, a little bit more common in the cities, but it was not quite that clear cut. And yeah, that was the overwhelming sort of predominant question of the period. We were coming out of a major economic slump in the 1890s. And, yeah, the whole idea was to establish a new country and a new economy, how was the best way to do that.
And, okay, so that's the ideological battleground, if you will. And so that first election in 1901, a minority government results.
Yes, they did end up with nobody having a majority. So Edmund Barton, who was already prime minister because he'd been appointed as a caretaker prime minister, was able to form a new government with, these days we would probably say, a confidence and supply arrangement with the Labor Party, the Labor members. I don't know if they used that term at the time, but for all intents and purposes, it was a sort of alliance where Barton was able to govern with Labor supporting him in exchange for some concessions to Labor policy.
Now, if I can go all Anthony Green here, as I understand it, the Protectionist Party won 31 seats, the Labor Party 14, is that right?
That sounds right.
The Free Trade Party won 28. So we have a interesting balance amongst, was it 75 seats in that first parliament?
Yes, half as big as it is now. And Alfred Deakin, who took over from Barton during that first parliament, called it the 3-11s when he was talking about cricket teams. He was talking about the difficulty of you can't play a cricket game with 3-11s. And eventually these parties did coalesce and they did merge into what we now have as you know, what they call the two-party system. It took a few years, but things did eventually settle down.
How did they go in that 1901 parliament? Did they get things done?
Yes, it was fairly successful for the most part. They did pass quite a few laws and formed the basis of Australian governments. They One of the first pieces of legislation that they passed was the Immigration Restriction Act, which is the formation, you know, the basis of the White Australia policy. We probably wouldn't call that a success in this day and age, but they certainly considered it that. They started the High Court with High Court Act, and they passed the Commonwealth Franchise Act, which gave the vote to most Australian women. And all of that took place in the first, you know, 2 years of that Parliament.
It's the extraordinary nation-building moment, is it not? Well, yeah, what a time. Mm. Let's jump forward. 1913, that was another close result as well.
Very. One seat. The Liberal Party, the Commonwealth Liberal Party, which is a different party than the modern Liberal Party, was led by Joseph Cook, who had been there all the way back in 1901. The characters will keep popping up over these stories. And he won 37 seats. Labor won only 36. So it was, you know, one seat majority. They had to rely on the Speaker's casting vote to pass some of their legislation through the House. And Andrew Fisher, who had been the Prime Minister up to that point from a Labor government, had had a very successful 3 years. But he did repeatedly try to change the Constitution with referendums. He submitted a referendum in 1911 and then another referendum in 1913. To sort of introduce some legal changes. And David Day later said that that's probably what hurt them. And it wasn't enough to give them a landslide loss, but it was just enough to lose them by a single seat. So Cook found himself Prime Minister as the First World War was approaching. And he had control of the House barely, but he didn't have the Senate because the Senate was still very strongly Labor. So he couldn't really do anything.
And we know where that can end, that lack of control in the Senate.
It ended exactly the way that you think. Being hamstrung by it, there was a particular piece of legislation that Cook wanted to pass, which was giving preference to union members when filling jobs in the Commonwealth and public service. Of course, Labor was opposed to that, and it was twice rejected by the Senate. So in 1914, Cook went to the Governor-General, Sir Ronald Munro Ferguson, and he asked for the first ever double dissolution, and he got it. And then he went on to lose that election quite decisively.
Well, and that was an interesting campaign because, of course, the First World War was called while the politicians were on the hustings.
Oh, yes. That second election in 1914, exactly right, and that was where Andrew Fisher pledging to defend, you know, Britain to the last man and the last shilling, where that famous quote comes from. And so it was only, you know, it was an election only a little more than a year after the last one, but you know the threat of war definitely would have dominated that campaign.
Yes. 1922, that's an election that was also close, but also, interestingly, the start of a long and sometimes turbulent relationship that endures to the very day. What happened in 1922?
Yes, that's a fascinating one. So in 1922, we had Billy Hughes, who was in charge of a nationalist government, and the nationalists had been formed by merging the former Liberal Party of Joseph Cook with Billy Hughes' own supporters. He had been thrown out of the Labor Party for supporting conscription. He'd managed to hang on to power by forming this new alliance and a new party called the Nationalists. He was up against Matthew Charlton, who was a dedicated union man and ex-coal miner, was in charge of the Labor Party. But the third, the sort of spanner in that works was the Country Party, which had just been formed in 1920 from some various rural members. And its leader, Earl Page, had campaigned on reducing spending, on agricultural tariffs and subsidies. But he'd campaigned against Hughes as much as Tudor. He called Hughes the prime dictator. And he accused Hughes of being reckless and wrecking the economy and having too much spending. And when the dust was settled, Labor, their vote and their seat count had gone up, but they didn't have anything close to a majority. So Page had the balance of power with the Country Party, and he was much more inclined to support the Nationalists rather than Labor. So I don't think he really entertained the idea of supporting Labor, but his price for backing a Nationalist government was Hughes standing down. And Hughes tried to hang on, but it was very clear he couldn't. So about 6 weeks after the election, he resigned, and Stanley Bruce took over as Prime Minister, and then he was the one who negotiated a coalition. And Page became treasurer. For all intents and purposes, he was deputy prime minister, although he didn't call himself that. And that's the beginning of the coalition between the two major non-Labor parties that has survived for most of the last century.
And a remarkable moment too, in that crossbenchers demand a change in leadership, and success. They get what they ask for.
That's right.
Let that be a warning to you all, current politicians. We're talking close elections here on Sunday Extra with Campbell Rhodes from the Museum of Australian Democracy. Just been talking about the events of 1922. And Campbell, we throw forward to 1940. Now, this, again, the world is at war, but young Robert Menzies calls an election.
Yes, and a very young Robert Menzies, actually. He was only in his 40s at the time. Menzies was such a dominant figure in politics for such a long time. And sometimes people kind of forget that he was actually prime minister twice, and the first time was at the beginning of the Second World War. And that 1940 election was another kind of inconclusive one. Menzies was leader of the United Australia Party, which had 36 seats, and Labor only won 32. But it had another four members of parliament who were Lang Labor. So they were part of the New South Wales Labor Party that had split off from the federal one. And then there were some independents who also got elected. So it was a minority government in 1940 that Menzies was able to form with the support of these two independents. They were Arthur Coles, who went on to be actually a founder of Coles Supermarkets, funnily enough, and Alex Wilson, both from Victoria. But that government didn't last very long, because Menzies was trying to prosecute the war. He went to Britain. By the time he came back, his government was sort of falling to pieces. He'd spent months in Britain, and eventually he resigned the coalition, went with Arthur Fadden to be the new prime minister. Our old friend Billy Hughes crops up again, because he was the most logical person to succeed Menzies, but he was 78.
An enduring figure.
Absolutely. At 78 years old, they thought that probably he might not have been the best person. So they went with Fadden, who lasted. Fadden used to say that he was like the Great Flood, because he reigned for 40 days and 40 nights. And after 40 days, those two independents, Coles and Wilson, changed sides and did a deal with Curtin. And the Fadden government was defeated in the House, and the Curtin government came to power.
And this is, I think, a salutary moment in the course of Australian politics, because that minority government would be, well, there would not be another one until Julia Gillard 70 years later.
That's right. And it was unusual even at the time for the government to change midterm without an election. It can happen with a minority government, but it was, I think it's the only time that that's actually happened. There's some debate about exactly why they decided to switch sides. And whether or not, you know, why they didn't call a new election. There's some suggestion that the Governor General might have played a role in trying to prevent another election from happening right away. it's not quite clear. But what is clear is that once everything had settled down, the Curtin government came into power, and the rest is really history. He was Prime Minister for the rest of his life and didn't quite manage to get to the end of the war. And he died 6 weeks before it ended.
1961. Post-war, and there are now 124 seats in the federal lower house. Labor and the coalition, 1961, win 62. What's to be done?
Yes, this is another. This is the closest election for quite a long time. Until 2010, it was the closest. Labor had won a majority of the popular, or that a plurality of the popular vote, and they'd won the two-party vote just. And they had a new leader in Arthur Calwell, who put a spirited fight up against Menzies. Menzies was normally had a lot of the media on his side, but on this particular occasion, the Sydney Morning Herald had switched sides to Labor, which was unusual. And on election night, it wasn't actually clear who had won. Labor picked up a lot of seats, but they both went to bed thinking that they were going to win. After about 10 days, it became clear that it was practically a dead heat. The last seat to be decided was Moreton in Brisbane. Jim Killen won that for the Liberal Party with about 130 votes on preferences from the Democratic Labor and, oddly, from the Communists. They got most of their votes went to Labor, but just enough went to Killen to win. And Killen always used to say that Menzies once phoned him up and said, "Killen, you are magnificent," but he actually made that up. He admitted that he made that up. But because it was practically a dead heat, in fact, it was literally a dead heat because they had 62 each. One of the interesting things about that parliament was that there were 124 members, but two of those members didn't get a vote. The member for the Northern Territory and the member for the ACT were represented in the House, but the only time that they were able to actually vote in the House was when it was directly connected to their own territory.
Isn't that a queer distinction?
Yeah. So for this particular election, they had 62 members, but two of Labor's couldn't vote. So you ended up with it being a 62-60 scenario. If it had been one extra seat the other way, 61-61, it would have been an entirely different dynamic. And there would have been, you know, they would have had to rely on the Speaker's casting vote again. As it was very, very tight, Menzies just managed to hang on.
Campbell, how wonderful to rattle through this extraordinary history. And it's such a compressed period, of course, the history of the Australian Federation, just back to 1901, as we discussed. An election campaign underway at the moment, and you're, Campbell, at the Museum of Australian Democracy. Does that give you an uptick in visitation as people focus on politics?
It might do, especially since, as in previous years, this year the museum is a polling place.
So of course.
If you do happen to be in Canberra on the 3rd of May, you are able to vote here, and we are also open for pre-polling. We'll have sort of activities for people to do while they are here voting. But anecdotally, I certainly have noticed that when there is an election on, people do ask a few more questions and sort of want to experience what we have to offer, absolutely.
What a great temptation to cast your vote in the old Parliament House at the Museum of Australian Democracy. I might make the journey, Campbell, who knows? Thank you so much. Campbell Rhodes is Copyright and Research Coordinator at the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.